Good morning. Nice to see you all. So this morning, before I give a talk, I would like to introduce Jody Williams, who has graciously agreed to be Zen Center's new board chair. And she's going to make an announcement.
Good morning, everyone. As you know, as many of you know, in the past, our guiding teacher, Timmy Burkett, has had some challenging health issues, which led him last year to announce that he would be stepping down in the fall of this year. And that news launched a process that took place over the last year to find a new leader. There were twists and turns along the way, most exciting among them. The news that Tim's health situation had improved dramatically, and with much improved health, Tim asked the board to reconsider his resignation. And at last week's board meeting, the board did just that, adapting a new leadership proposal developed by Tim with the help of Sangha priests. And so we wanted to make a brief announcement today to let you know about that. The new leadership structure consists of Tim as guiding teacher, Ted O'Toole, who Tim has appointed as his guiding teacher, and then a consortium of up to four priests who, appointed by Tim, will be responsible for various duties to be defined over the coming months. It's a little bit different, and it's a little bit the same, essentially formalizing a structure that's been emerging here over time, so I think it'll feel familiar to everyone. With Rahatsu this week, and Tim's planned vacation immediately following, there really isn't time for a community meeting, so we wanted to get the news out as soon as possible. We sent an email, if we have your email. I believe we also send out a mailing. And we'll continue to share news of how the leadership structure is developing over time, how it's evolving, and with opportunities for updates and community conversation in 2014. The announcement, I think, some members of the board and the priests will be here during coffee hour. Just grateful for everyone who helped with this process. We're grateful for Tim's improved health. And thank you all.
Okay, thanks, Jody. So there's that. So what do we think? Kim especially has gotten quite a lot of feedback on the way this leadership thing has been resolved, and there's been a lot of positive feedback, and I hope this is something that everyone is comfortable with. If you just heard about this for the first time, it might still be sinking in. But what it means is, really, we have a few details to work out yet, but basically we're going forward with the same kind of leadership structure that we've had for quite a long time. And I don't know about you, but I'm feeling pretty relieved. This process is over now, I think. We've come to a resolution. We've been doing this for a long time. So I think it's great. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit more. But first, I want to talk about some other things, a little serious Zen first, because I want to put this in the context of practice. So this morning, I'd like to expand a little bit on a talk I gave at Practice Period. Some of you were there and you heard it. Our text for this period was called Living by Vow by Shohaku Okamura, and it was an explanation of various chants that we do here at Zen Center, because this was based on talks he wrote when he was our interim guiding teacher back in the early 90s. And one of the chapters was on a chant called The Harmony of Difference and Sameness. Some of you know it as the merging of difference and unity. That's a different translation. So sometimes in this talk, I'm going to refer to difference and sameness. Sometimes difference and unity. It's the same thing. So I talked just a bit during practice period about this chant in relation to Sangha, and that's the part I would like to expand upon today. This chant, or you could call it a poem, it was composed by Shirto Sichien. He lived in China from 700 to 790, so it's quite an old chant. He was a Dharma grandson of Wei Nung, whom many of you are familiar with. The Japanese version of his name is Sekito Kisen. And this chant, it's in our chant books, and we chant it now and then, we study it. And in fact, Tim talked about it in his Dharma talk just 2 weeks ago. And he focused on these lines, the lines that are on your program, In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. And in his talk, he described how Suzuki Roshi went to Yosemite and how he saw the very, very high waterfall that is there in Yosemite, and how these little rivulets of water were sort of streaming off of the falls and kind of disappearing into the air. And if I remember correctly, he said that Suzuki thought that the little rivulets looked lonely. And Tim talked about the longing to be connected with all life. And it occurred to me as I was listening to him that I wonder how much of what we do is because of our longing to be connected with all life and because of our longing to sort of be freed from separation and loneliness. And I'm thinking maybe just about everything. And I think about how I've done things in my life and I haven't really understood my own motivations. And later I kind of realize, oh yeah, that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to connect. And here's an example. I made this decision to go to law school. And I'm still asking myself, where did that come from? You know, people say to me, oh, you're a priest and you're a lawyer. Well, that's just confusing. And I'm a little confused about that too. But I think I know why I did it. When I was really little, you know, people ask you, what do you want to be when you're grown up, and your parents instill little ideas in you without you realizing they're doing it. And I can remember my mom saying, well, you could be a lawyer. Lawyers need to know a lot about a lot of different things. I'll bet that's why I did it. I'll bet it was this desire. I didn't really know what to do, what to go into, and it was this desire to connect with my mom. And I did. And she came to my graduation, and she said, we're so proud of you. And it made her happy. So it was good. It was good. So we have this longing. And I think of this great longing I have to connect with my past. Some of this stuff comes out in my Dharma talks. I think about my childhood on the farm in North Dakota, and I think about my construction worker days, you know. And I love to talk about that stuff. And I think it's just trying to connect directly with vivid life, you know. We think back on times when our lives were particularly vivid, and we have this hunger for life, you know. We want to be back there. And I think you could say that this chant, the harmony of difference and sameness, is really about that connection. It's about that connection. And Tim said that in Christianity, this longing is tied in with the idea that we have been ripped from the fabric of the universe. We're separate, you know, we're separate. But in Zen, he said, we are the fabric. The whole waterfall is in the rivulet. And the reason the rivulet is lonely is just because it doesn't know. It's the whole waterfall. And when it knows, when it slows down and sits and lets go of thought and realizes it is the waterfall, then it's okay. Then there's no separation there. So, and I think that's the essence of this teaching. The rivulet cannot be separated from the waterfall. And yet at the same time, it can. You know, things don't have an independent existence. They don't exist apart from everything else. And yet, in a way, they do. You know, there is no Ted that exists independently from all other things that can really be separate. And yet, here I am. I'm giving the talk. So there's sameness and there's difference. And there's harmony. So what's the harmony? The harmony is that these two things exist simultaneously. And they're not even two things at all. Not really. And we have to somehow hold these two contradictory ideas in our mind at the same time. This is something that happens in meditation or in mindful activity. It's not something that's logical. It's experiential. It's something that just kind of happens with practice. And it happens without practice. But it may be so fleeting, we don't even see it. We don't even understand it. So, in the chant, there are different ways of looking at difference and sameness, and one of them is in terms of speech. It says that sounds differ as pleasing or harsh, and then it says, refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. I'll repeat that. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. So as humans, we like to make distinctions between things. For instance, we have preferences about the kind of speech we like, harsh, pleasant speech. There's one kind that we like, and there's one kind that we don't like. That's the world of distinctions. We need to make distinctions, of course, in order to survive, and we spend most of our lives in the world of distinctions. That is the world of light, using the metaphor of this poem. But in the dark, refined and common speech come together. The dark is the world beyond distinctions, even beyond the distinction between distinctions and non-distinctions. And in this world, refined and common speech come together. Each of these things contains the other, or we might say each of these things contains the seeds of the other. In harsh speech, there's pleasant speech. In pleasant speech, there is harsh speech. And in our practice, we find that because one thing is contained in another, all distinctions that we come up with are really, in a way, arbitrary. All is interrelated, and there's no principle for organizing the world which is ultimately defensible, other than because it's useful. So it's in examples, I think, that these things really come alive. And Shohaku, in his book, gives the example of the hand and the five fingers. On my hand, each finger is an individual thing. It's easily isolated and named. This is a finger, this is another finger. And yet we can also isolate and name the hand, the total hand. Well, which is more real? Which is the actual thing? Which is the real thing here? Is it the finger or is it the hand? Is it the individuals or is it the group? And of course, neither one is more real than the other. These are just mental constructions. These are just giving names to something that can't be named. But if we go beyond the words, we see the components exist as components. The whole exists as the whole. And try as we might to choose one thing over the other, we cannot do it. And all of the universe is like this hand. We have, like the fingers, we have the myriad individual things. We have you, and we have me, and we have Manjushri, and we have the light coming in, and we have the lake. We have all of these individual things. These are the five fingers. And on the other hand, we have the vast interrelatedness of all things, where there really are no distinction between things. And that's the hand. And which is more real? Things exist, but they don't exist. And both of these things are true at the same time. True and contradictory. So there's another example of the harmony and difference and sameness that I would like to develop a little closer to home. This is Thanksgiving weekend. Family has been on my mind quite a lot lately, so I'd like to talk about that. I hope you all had a great Thanksgiving. I've always said that I think Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday because it's really simple. All you do is you get together with people you love, which might be your family or it might be your friends, and you hang out and you enjoy each other, and it's all about gratitude, you know. It's all about what we're grateful for. It's not about indulging ourselves, not really, you know. It's about expressing our gratitude, giving, not receiving. So it's simple and it's great. And our family's Thanksgiving was a little different this year. I gave a Dharma talk, I think maybe it was in August or so, where I talked a little bit about my mother-in-law and how we moved her to a nursing home not too long ago. Well, this year we had our Thanksgiving dinner at the nursing home. My mother-in-law, I talked in my in that talk about how the day that Kathy and I, my wife Kathy and I, took her there to the nursing home and got her checked in, about what that day was like, how we went downstairs after dinner with her, and we were outside and we were listening to some music. There was a guy playing the banjo and singing, and how there was this beautiful evening light, and our hearts were so open because that was such a profound day in our lives, you know, having to do this thing. And looking over at Ginny and seeing her smile and looking at the beautiful light and looking around and seeing all these people listening, you know, a lot of them in wheelchairs and just various forms of being sort of disabled, and just seeing the beauty of these people, and being able to look past any kind of disability or anything like that. And and it was really transforming. And Kathy said, I thought I was compassionate before, but something really happened there. And we both really, really felt that. And we were grateful for that. And we like going back there. We go back there a lot because there's a lot of suffering in nursing homes, but there's something else too. It's like people sort of drop their pretenses and you can really see them for who they are and you can see their beauty. It's so very, very apparent. And you can see what people want. They want to connect. You know, they're the rivulet and they want to connect. They want to connect with the fall. And for Kathy and me, the nursing home is like, it's like sacred space. I realized this, like, on Thanksgiving Day, that when we enter that building, we act a little differently. We start walking a little differently. It's like the difference between going to a movie and going to a formal retreat here at Zen Center. You know, here at Zen Center, you walk in a very respectful way. You're aware of everything around you. You have this respect. You have this quiet. Your body kind of takes on this tone of gratitude. And that's what we do. That's what we do in the nursing home, I think. So we were lucky to have our Thanksgiving dinner there. So it was less like a party this year, and it was more like spiritual practice, you know. And we got a room which had a little kitchen in it and had a long table, and there were nine of us there. And we had our usual Thanksgiving dinner, and we went around the table as we do every year and talked about what we're grateful for, you know. And Virginia, my mother-in-law, said she's grateful for family, you know, and that was really sweet. And she was really feeling joyful that day, you know. But it's hard. It's really hard because, like, when she got tired later on, she said, I want to go home now. And we said, oh, you mean you want to go upstairs? And she goes, oh, yeah, I'm here now. Like, she had forgotten, you know. And so we're going around and we're all saying what we're grateful for, you know. And we all mentioned family, and there's such joy there, such joy at being together. And also the pain of that occasion, too. And those two things are so inseparable. You know, right in joy, there is that sadness. Right in the sadness, there is joy. It's just vivid life, you know. It's just vivid life. So that's kind of, you know, the serious side of Thanksgiving. There's another thing about Thanksgiving that helped me to think a little bit about sameness and difference, which is not quite so serious. I said that Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday because it's simple, and that can be really true, but it seems like the simplicity is leaving Thanksgiving, because if you paid attention to the news this year, what's the big news about Thanksgiving? The big news is shopping. It's about the expansion of Black Friday. You know, people are opening their stores earlier and earlier. And what used to be about family seems to be more and more about consumerism, you know. So I'm wondering, what happened to the gratitude? You know, this is all about acquisition. Something's going wrong here, you know. And I get a little upset about that. And I find, you know, that usually when I get upset, there's something I can learn there. You know, usually there's more to learn about myself than there is about the exterior thing that's upsetting me. And I think that's true in this case, too. So I was looking at a newspaper, one of the local newspapers, and there was this photograph in there of this guy who was camping out at Best Buy. Maybe some of you saw it. And he started camping out on Sunday night so he could get the best Black Friday deals on Thursday. So that's like 4 days, you know, camping on a tent on a sidewalk between a building and a parking lot. And my first reaction was to be judgmental about this, right? Like, wow, how, you know, there must be better things to do, right? And I really saw that in myself. I really saw that judgment in myself. And I wanted to examine that a little bit. There was more information in this caption about this guy in the picture. And one of the things it said was he does this every year. The other thing it said is he gives away most of what he buys to worthy causes, you know. And that gave me pause. Well, oh, if he's not doing it out of greed, what's he doing it for? He's doing it, he's giving the stuff away. So what's going on here? What's going on here? Well, I think he's found a way to serve others, you know. He's doing something that helps other people. And just maybe he's also found a way to have this great adventure, you know, a great adventure, and to do something really difficult and to find out what he's made of inside. I mean, it can't be easy to camp out in the cold for 4 days on a sidewalk like that. So how is this different from our spiritual practice? You know, how is it different? He's doing something really hard, like what we do in retreat, finding out something about himself, and he's doing it for other beings. So forget the judgment. I like this guy. I'd like to meet this guy. I'd like to be this guy. So if I'm really not any different from this guy, am I really any different from all of those other shoppers that I could be so judgmental about, you know? And I don't think I am. I think we're all trying to engage in a really vivid way with our lives, and there are lots of ways to do that, you know. And right in shopping, there is spiritual practice, and right in spiritual practice, there is shopping. It's here. It's here. And for a lot of people, it's a lot of fun, I'm sure. And I just, you know, shopping's not my thing, but I know it can be really fun. But I used to be so judgmental about people when I was younger, particularly when I was kind of a political activist. And I really liked to divide the world into good and bad and side with the good people and oppose the bad people. And invariably, I was with the good people. And the other, and there over here, there were the bad people. And I'm now a lot more careful about doing that. Because one thing I realized was that in order to really keep up this scheme I had made of the good people versus the bad people, I had to ignore some information. You know, like I maybe had to ignore the fact that these people I had seen as bad did some really nice things. And I was trying to convince myself, well, they're just doing it because, you know, because they're bad and they're trying to get something out of it. Not true. The world is a lot more complex than I thought. So I'm a lot more careful now to examine judgment when I see it coming in. And that doesn't mean that I accept bad behavior. It means that I see the bad behavior with the understanding that the seeds of that bad behavior are in me as well. And the seeds of good behavior are in everyone. And the solution is to oppose the bad behavior both in myself and others, not to divide the world into what is good and bad. So in the light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark, there is light, but don't see it as light. We contain within us all things, but don't see them as things. Don't give them a name. Don't limit it with words. So we can see the harmony of difference and sameness in family. There's difference in any family, different ways of looking at what's important in the world. But there's also sameness in families. You know, families come together and they set aside their differences, and there's this thing called family which is larger than any person there. And larger than the sum of all the people there. And another way to look at the harmony of difference and sameness is to look at our Sangha, which is a bit like a very large family, I think. And it seems like this is a good time to step back and kind of take a look at our Sangha. One thing about Sangha is that it's not very clearly definable. One way we could define Sangha is to say, well, it's the members. And I don't know, I think we may have something like 130 members now or something. But that doesn't really capture it because there are so many other people. We have a much larger community of people who are active here, but they're not members. And we have how many people, hundreds, maybe thousands of people, who have practiced here in the past and aren't with us right now but may come back, and this place is still a part of them, and it always will be a part of them. And there are people who have never visited this place but feel like they're a part of it. Maybe they listen to the talks online, or maybe they have a long-distance relationship with a teacher here, or maybe they've read Katagiri's books, you know. They know this place. They know this place. And there's the larger Zen community in the Twin Cities, and we're intimately connected with that. And the Zen community in this country, and Buddhists all around the world. But However we define the Sangha has sameness or unity. And I think that's pretty easy to see. There's this thing that is larger than all of us. And it's been going on here for 40 years. And it's going to be going on a lot longer than that. And that's the waterfall. You know, that's like the blending of voices in chanting. When we do a chant, and we really chant with our ears, when we're not concerned with sort of projecting ourselves and asserting what great chanters we are, but instead we're trying to blend in with everyone else and just find that place so that the whole sounds really beautiful, that's the waterfall. You know, and each of us is the whole in that moment. If we're really letting ourselves go and just doing the chant and letting our voices blend, each of us is the whole. There's no separation there. And when we talk about retreats, doing retreats here, we often talk about the container. That's a word that we use. We say we don't want too many people coming and going during the retreat because that will affect the container. The group won't have such a great focus if that happens. So the container is the supportive structure of the retreat, the silence and the respect and the dignity that we all develop together. It's created by all of us, and each of us is the container. That's the unity, the sameness. But we also have difference. When we become part of the Sangha, we all bring different experiences to it. We have different expectations, and we all have different needs from practice. Some people, for instance, love traditional practice, and other people love more contemporary practice. And if you know me very well, you know which one I am drawn to. You also know that I like our present balance, and I think it's pretty good that we're doing both things so that everyone can find a place. Some people are pretty solitary in their practice, and some people are more social. Some take a more scholarly approach. Some are more experiential. Some folks like to express their practice through bodhisattva work in the community, and they like it that Zen Center is finding these opportunities to do that and can help them find ways to participate in the community. Other people do bodhisattva work all the time out of Zen Center, and they come here to find a refuge and a place of rest. So they're not signing up for those things. And that's just great, you know. We do both of those things. Some people like the idea of a rapidly growing center, and they love a really big crowd. Some people have an idea for something a little cozier. Myself, I really like growth. I think rapid growth would be a lot of fun. But I'm glad that there are other people who are a little more cautious and a little more practical, because they'll probably help to rein me in and we'll reach the happy medium there. Some people want a single full-time teacher, and others think that we can be led by a part-time teacher or a group of teachers. Some like a more hierarchical structure. Some like a more cooperative structure. Some like making a formal commitment and having a steady practice and coming here very steadily over years, and others move in and out of the orbit of Zen Center. Some are in this sort of very steady orbit like the Earth or Saturn or Mars or something, and some are more like comets. They come around once in a great while and they burn very brightly. We love those people. We love them all. And I think just about everybody agrees that this diversity is a good thing. And we have a large priest staff here, and that's a very diverse group, too. The priests have very different teaching styles, and most people, I think, agree that that's a strength. You can hear different approaches to the Dharma on different Sundays. If you'd like to meet with a teacher, you have a number of choices as to what type of teacher you'd like to meet with, someone who's just like you. Or maybe you'd like to meet with a teacher who is not just like you because you'd like to be challenged. Or maybe you would like to try all of them and see what it is that you do need because you haven't decided yet. So diversity is our strength. And with diversity, of course, there are challenges. We have a very wide divergence of views about the best way to do Zen practice, about the best way to teach Zen, about how to organize this thing that we're doing all together. And these views can be strong because we care about this place so very much. you know, if you've really put your heart into this place and it's become a big part of your life and you're really committed to it, maybe over a period of years, of course, you're really going to care. You're really going to want your voice to be heard. You're going to want to be assertive about what you want to do here. So we each have a personal vision. And at the heart of it is our vision about practice and sharing the practice. And for those who choose to get involved in deciding the direction of the center, and not everyone does, and that's just fine, we have a lot of good discussions, and we have some long meetings, sometimes some very long meetings, and sometimes we even, of course, have a bit of conflict, and maybe even a little bit of ego now and then, a little bit of territoriality, you know? It can happen. It can happen. It's there in each and every one of us, right? It's there. It's there. At least the seeds are there. So as a community, we've been looking at the Sangha's leadership for quite a long time now. And for about a year, we've been dealing directly with this issue of what the leadership structure is going to be like. And as Jody said, it started when Tim said he was going to be stepping down for health reasons about a year ago. And then things happened that made it more complicated. Tim, his health really recovered, and things were going in a different direction. And there has been some conflict. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. I'm not going to go into detail about it. I don't want to overemphasize it. It hasn't been that bad. I think we've come through this pretty well. But this is a Dharma talk, and I don't think this is the appropriate time to go into detail. There are some documents. There was an email sent out to everyone about this decision to all the members, and there was a link to some documents sort of about how we got to this decision. And if you have questions, anything about the process, I'd be happy to meet with you, discuss it with you. I'm sure the other priests would as well. But conflict is interesting because it tends to bring out our habitual reactions, don't you think? We kind of revert to the things we learned maybe a long time ago. No matter how long we've been practicing, we're still a product of our past. We still have these habitual ways of doing things. And I can see these things kicking in sometimes when I'm under stress. That, oh, that's what I want to do, you know? But I think I've learned to see that when it happens and pay attention to it and acknowledge it and hopefully not be carried away by it. One tendency that I see is the tendency to harden my position. You know, I begin to draw lines between what is right and wrong, and I side with the right. And I try to keep that wrong defined as wrong so I can oppose it like I did when I was younger. You know, and when we do this, sometimes we receive little bits of information that don't fit our hardened position, and at that point, we have a choice. We can absorb those bits of information and we can re-examine our position, or we can kind of push those away and say, well, those don't fit. I'm sticking to my position. It's sort of like willfully not letting in all the information. And another tendency we have is just to flee, just to run away. Because we come to Zen Center for a refuge, right? We don't want any conflict here, ever. I think that when we look at the Sangha, we tend to see the unity part a little bit, and not see the difference part. It's hard to see that we can have conflict and that things can become difficult because Buddhists shouldn't have conflict ever, right? Buddhists should get along all of the time. But Buddhists are human and they have differences and that will always be with us. That's the difference part. And accepting the difference part is our practice. Difference and unity. It's like your family. You love them, and there's probably now and then some conflict there. We can't escape samsara and enter nirvana as a community. Our life is our life. And our practice is to stay with our life. Our practice is to stay right with things even when they get difficult. To stand up in the moment and see our tendency to harden and see our tendency to want to run away and to stay with those emotions and examine them and not be carried away by them. To stay right there on that edge. That is our practice. To open our hearts at the times when we most want to close them. That's our practice. And that is not easy. But I'm happy to report, I think that's what's happened in our community. I think that's what's happened. And it's a really good thing. Because just recently, this wonderful thing happened, which was that the unity, I thought, manifested itself in the midst of all of this difference. And I wasn't sure we'd be able to do it, but we did. And a lot of people get credit for this. The staff and the board and the priests. And a lot of us have worked hard on this. And a number of Sangha members have taken a very active part in this process. But I especially want to give credit to the board. And just to clarify, I'm on the board. Ben is on the board. But we've stepped back from this leadership process. We haven't participated in it, except a couple of times when asked. So when I'm talking about the board here, I'm not talking about Ben and me. But the board members worked really hard, and they had to keep this process going through some kind of sudden and difficult changes of direction. I think there's a kind of vulnerability that comes with being in a leadership position in an organization like this, because you have to make hard choices. And you get this feeling that no matter what choice you make, someone is probably going to be disappointed in that. And that's very difficult. There's just nothing you can do about that. You have to accept that difficulty as part of the role. And the board reached a decision, and they got kind of a strong reaction from some folks, and they could have hardened their positions, and they could have just given up, but they were willing to take another look at it, and I saw them softening and opening their hearts, and I found this inspiring. I really did. Because this is the really tough Zen practice, to come to that difficult place and open your heart there. I mean, this makes a shin look easy. This makes 7 days of staring at a wall look easy. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you guys on the board. And from comments I've seen or read the past few days, I think a lot of other people feel that same way. And I really hope we haven't burnt you guys out. I'm a little afraid we may have, but I hope you'll get some rest over the holidays and do some sitting and come back and be ready for more. And we promise we'll be nice. So what happened was we had this meeting of all of the priests and all of the board. And the board brought this openness that I talked about. I mean, they really brought this openness. And the priests brought this openness too. And you know what happened? Every person in the room had an idea about how the leadership of the Sangha should be, because we had all of these possibilities to choose from. And probably, I think every person in that room was willing to give up and did give up something of their vision about how things should be. And every person in that room was able to agree on a solution. The solution is something every person in that room was okay with. And that's what we have. That's what Jody announced. And it's basically a continuation of what we have. And I think we've learned something from this. I probably shouldn't say we, because I'm actually speaking for myself here. And I think whenever I talk about how I think the Sangha should be, it's always provisional, because I can't make anything happen, right? It's like I have an idea of what there should be, and I can put forth that idea, and a lot of people talk about it, and a lot of people hash it out, and the right thing happens as a result of all of those people working together, and we don't know where we're going, and we get something, and it's the right thing, and it's probably really far from my idea. And that's the way things work here, and that's the way they should work. But so I'm speaking for myself when I say this, but I think one thing that's apparent from our process is that it's very important to be very open about all of our processes and involve the entire Sangha and be very clear about what's going on and to give people opportunities for input and make clear what those opportunities are. And I think I would really like to try to support ways to make that happen. And I think that could be a very good thing that comes out of this process. So we have Sangha difference and we have Sangha unity. And where does the harmony come in? Well, I think that comes in with our future practice. So we have this unified vision now, and we can move forward. We have this thing we've agreed upon about how the Sangha is going to work. And along with that, we have all of our individual views that make this mixture so rich. And again, we're going to have all of these voices coming together to find the right thing. And together, we're going to be willing to stay on that edge and find that opening of the heart. We have to do that as a community, right? We can't just do that individually and not do that as a community. And so we find a path that we can all walk together. That's our practice, always. That's our practice, staying right on that edge with gentleness and with courage. And I know that we can do that. And to say that I'm excited about the future of Zen Center right now is a great understatement, because I am really excited about the future of Zen Center at this point. If you look around at the kinds of participation we've been getting lately, of the number of people who have been coming to our talks, at how Tuesday night gathering is going, about how we often have to turn people away from the introduction on the third floor, how we have too many shoes and too many coats, we need a new shoe rack, we need a new coat rack. We have classes, practice period, morning study group, retreats. We have a lot of people coming to learn about the Dharma, people who really want the Dharma in their lives. And we don't have room for everyone. So, what are we going to do about this? Well, we're going to turn our attention to the building. It's like we've been distracted for a long time. We've really got to get serious about the building now. There's been quite a lot of work done on the building, but now we really have to get serious. So what's going to happen? Are we going to stay here? Are we going to go somewhere else? I've got an idea, which is sort of the perfect Zen contradictory idea, that we both stay here and go somewhere else. And this is probably not the time to explain that. Sometime I'd like to have an opportunity to explain the whole thing to you. But something's going to happen, and it's going to be good. And it's not just the building. What kinds of programming are we going to develop? And we've really made great strides in our community participation. What's going to happen there? And what about our family programming? We've really gotten off to a great start on that. And who will the next initiates be? And who will the next teachers be? And what's it going to be like having multiple teachers ordaining multiple priests? We don't know, but it's going to be pretty exciting. And whatever we do, I think we are really ready to enter this new phase because we are really strong. Because of all of the things we have, which are too many to list, but we have Katagiri's legacy. We have our history and our traditions, not just the 2,500 years of Buddhist traditions, but our 40 years of tradition here at Zen Center. And we have continued leadership from Tim. It was Tim that brought us to this point. It was Tim that ordained all of these priests and made it possible for all of this programming and all of this expansion to occur. And how is it that somehow I've gone to see Tim about 2,000 times, and about 1,000 of those times I was troubled about something, and every time he makes me feel not only that everything's going to be okay, but that I can just do anything. How does that happen? That keeps happening. We have Kimberly, who is works in our office and is the super glue that keeps the organization together. We have the priests, who in some ways are really highly visible, but in some ways they do their work so quietly that none of us really know everything that they do. And I really can't begin to convey all that they do. They've made a lifetime commitment to the Dharma, a lifetime commitment to service. You know, it doesn't end. It's like you can't go back. That's a huge, huge, huge thing. And we have the board, whom I've already talked about, and we have our long-term practitioners. I've been coming here for 20 years now, and sometimes I feel like a newcomer because we have a lot of people who have been coming here 25 or 30 or 35 years. We have people who were here 40 years ago when Katagiri came, and they're still here. People with thousands of hours of meditation experience. And these people are real Sangha treasures. And we really need to value them. And we really need to take care of them if they need it. And we have people who've been here not as long, but they're active in the community, and they've taken on volunteer roles, and they're here steadily, and they're here when something needs to be done, and they'll be willing to do it. And these people are the backbone of the Sangha. And we also have newer people who are just getting to know us. And we have brand new people, people who are here for the very first time today. If you're here for the very first time today, I hope that you'll check us out, learn what practice is all about, get to know the various teachers, and above all, do the practice. And maybe, if it feels right, if the practice goes well, you'll stay and help us to build this thing, which I think is just about the most beautiful thing we could possibly build. Because think of the changes that this practice can make in one person's life. And then multiply that by hundreds or maybe thousands of people. And think of it carrying down through future generations. Think about Dharma Family Sunday and youth group. Think about those kids. If you were at our 40th anniversary pageant, you heard the kids talking in the pageant about what practice might be like for them many years from now. And ask yourself, what will the Dharma be like for these kids in 50 years or in 80 years? What kind of building will we be in then? I say we because we'll still be here. Our actions now are going to make it possible for these kids to practice. And our actions now are going to affect things in a very positive way for generations to come. I think for many generations to come. And I think what we're doing can all be summed up in one word, one very short word, and that word is love. It's just love. That's what we're doing. And I'm so grateful to be a part of it, and I'm so grateful to walk this path with all of you. So, thank you. So, does anyone have anything to add? Yes, James.
My organization, where I work, the institution where I work, has gone through a revisioning process and changes in leadership that were at once internally motivated and then, both times. We lost our president tragically, actually, recently, after this long period of revisioning and changing the direction of the university and really taking a much wider, broader view about what we wanted to become as an organization. And one of the goals was to grow enrollment tenfold within 10 years, where enrollment was fixed. It wasn't growing. And that was a problem because if we wanted to do new things, if we wanted to continue to grow, then we need revenue, and that meant enrollment. That's our largest source of revenue. So we have a small building, and we can't fit 10 times as many students as we have currently in the building.
Mm-hmm.
And so we looked at other models, and one of those, of course, is universities that give online programming, and I don't know if that's something that's come up on the radar. Many institutions that offer educational opportunities have gone that way. You say, well, it's here, but it's also in some other place. That could be many other places.
Yeah.
A new way to connect with.
Yeah.
A lot larger.
That's interesting. And that has come up. I think especially of people who are pretty isolated, who live, you know, far away in small towns and they don't have any Sangha near them. And even there's Zen teachers out there that live in these remote places too. And if all these people could be sort of connected online, that would be a really beautiful thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks. Anything else? Any other comments? Yes.
As someone who's been in and out of this place for a number of years, I just want to, but you know, I'm still kind of like an objective observer of what you think about Mr. Sanka.
Mm-hmm.
I want to commend you on really having an input from the community in Sanka and being so open to everybody's opinion and the diversity that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes that's talked about, but it doesn't actually get out.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are certain people who are stronger than others, and who, you know, within any organization, there are always those who talk the loudest. And I feel that is absolutely the right thing to do for a spiritual community.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciate that. I do. I think that openness is good. And I think I've, in my talk today, I've gone to some uncomfortable places. I think it's good. It's good to go there. We need to go there. We need to acknowledge that stuff, you know, and we need to move on. So there it is. Let's not dwell on it. Let's move forward and let's have some fun, you know. Let's be a little playful, okay? Yeah, because, you know, it's that. Okay, that was a year. It was like 3 years. We've been talking about this stuff forever. It's done now. Let's relax, okay? Well, shall we end on that note?